This is Susan Mazzoli, and you're listening to Light on Conspiracies.
I'm convinced that it is one of the most unjust wars that has ever been fought in the history of the world.
Welcome back to Light on Conspiracies, the second part for subscribers only.
Stuff. It seems like all this computer stuff kind of pulls your mind into that right brain area that's more connected to the ego. And when you do the spiritual stuff, it's like I don't even like being around computers or electricity or anything.
No, I hear what you're saying, but I feel quite balanced in it. I've spent so many years doing it, so it's not affecting me so badly, but I hear what you're saying. So now it's working here, but I really think that, you know, sometimes when you have computer problems and it just continues and continues, doesn't matter what you're doing, the thing is to turn it off, take a walk, clear yourself, come back, and then often it just starts working again. So it's almost like you're affecting it, or it's you affecting you. I don't know what it is. It's like but there's something going on there. When you get really frustrated and irritated with it, it's like a woman. It will just fight back. And
boy, truer words were never spoken.
Nope. Listen, Cody, can I ask you offline? You said that your son was gone. What happened there?
When my wife of 31 years, she had a massive heart attack, and it was not related to any kind of operations. It was just something that happened, and she was spent 10 days in the cardiac intensive care ward, and it was like $21,000 a day for 10 days.
Oh, God.
And, yeah, I know. But what happened was she survived, but we didn't find out till later that when her heart stopped that she had brain damage. And so what happened, it took us a while to discover it. She totally changed. Her personality completely changed. She couldn't live up here at the altitude anymore. And so she went down to Texas to stay with her relatives, and took our son with her. And so I was in the middle of all that prison stuff back then, and then my wife had the heart attack, and so I lost a lot of money in legal bills and medical bills. But anyway, they're okay. She's just not the same person. I mean, you can look in her eyes, and her eyes are clear and bright, but she's not there. So it was a bad blow, and it was hard. But now I realize this is so I could do this work, because to speak truth like I'm doing to a big police state like America, and America's the worst one in the world. I mean, this country's horrible. But I couldn't have a family around me. I'd be too afraid.
Oh, but I'm happy to hear that. So your son is okay, and so?
Yes, he's fine. Everything's fine. And he's not here, but I had worried about my family like that, but he's all grown. He's 20 years old now, and she's, so I'm in the perfect spot to do this work. And then me and you meeting, you know, like this, and everything's falling together.
Yeah.
A spiritual synchronicity, that's what we call it.
Yeah, divine synchronicity, I totally do agree. But I have a very good feeling that you're going to meet up with your son again on the other side of all of this crap. So, good time.
Yeah, so we have a deal with some friends. You know, if we ever get any money out of any of this, we're going to build I have a healing center here, but we're going to build a big one. The money from this book, if we get any, is going to be turned into helping children and helping stuff. It's going to be a real healing center, because some of the people, like that woman called me last night, she was a missionary down in Nicaragua, and they're all about, like Mother Teresa did in the slums in India and stuff, is actually bringing the light and just trying to do good. Because I did bad for a while, and now I want to make up for it.
Mm. Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. Okay, Cody, so let's get going. Let's use this time. Would you mind? I'm just going to, my sweetheart is in the room, so she, I'm just.
Oh, I did that again.
Okay, and hang on 2 seconds.
Okay.
Stay here,
though.
I'm sorry, she didn't get it. She didn't know that I was recording.
Oh, yeah, I can hear her. She's talking to somebody back there.
Yeah. No, the thing is, her name is Kim as well. So when I saw when I saw your email, I just thought Cody and Kim and Ole and Kim, it's just one of these synchronicity things again.
Yeah, Kim was here for 3 years. And, boy, you just all that, like you said about the women, Kim was so beautiful, blonde hair and blue eyes and long legs. Oh, my goodness, my goodness.
Hmm. You just described my Kim, so.
Yeah.
But no, she's we've stuck together for it's like 18, 19 years now. So she's a strong lady. She's been by my side all the time. So that's wonderful.
That is wonderful.
But Cody, please tell me about Black Ops from the inside point of view. Anything you want to share, how it's all set up, how a normal type of, if you got sort of a task, how would that be, how would you be approached, what would your part be, how would it be delivered and performed and so on?
Well, if you're going to do ongoing Black Ops, you know, over a period of time, It's kind of like a crescendo in music. You start, like I began working with certain people, and you have to build trust, because in Black Ops, that's all you have is trust. And when the trust fails, people get killed. And so it's a real black and white thing. But over a period of time, you know, you like what I did, I started out real small doing certain things, and then you move forward, and if you can handle them and everything occurs without any blowback and without any problem, then the people may hand you bigger things or bigger deals. And then over a period of years, you develop contacts, and then if you move to a different country, through your contacts, you have to, when you get to that country, start the same process over and over. So it's a process where there's trust built and integrity built with your word. And then the other thing is can you actually complete the missions and get payment? And everyone gets paid, because that's what a black op is. It's generally an illegal, whatever country you're in, they all have different laws. But it's an illegal operation of some kind. And the bottom line is to get paid. The principals get paid, everyone makes money, and then you pick up and go on to the next black op. But some of the ops, there's all kinds of things in the black ops. Some of them are... Well, at the very top of them is assassination ops, where they hire people to, you know, to assassinate people. And those are extremely delicate. They require the utmost level of trust. And then there's lower level ops, like moving contraband, like in Africa, they may have the blood diamonds. And you need to move them up to Antwerp, Belgium, or somewhere like that. There's drug ops, arms is a big one worldwide. So then there's lower level ops, like for corporations, corporations trying to get the timber down in the Amazon, or control of water supply otherwise, and they have to, fend off the indigenous people in the area to get contracts for the water and so forth. So there's corporate black ops where there's above board corporations that, in the public's eye, appear to be legitimate, and then underneath them, they have black ops. An example of that here in America is the Monsanto Corporation. A lot of people know them. They have a pretty bad reputation for the GMOs, genetically modified foods and stuff. So what Monsanto did, they bought...
I know, we call them Mon Diablo.
Yeah, and so a lot of people may not know this, but Eric Prince was a U.S. Navy SEAL, and he started a company called Blackwater, had a big training facility here in the States, and he took a lot of ex-military guys, and they would train them, and then they formed a company to make contractors, and these were contract assets that took on bodyguard jobs and so forth, and the U.S. State Department hired him to provide support to embassy personnel, or for instance, when they had the Hurricane Katrina down in New Orleans here in America, they needed a lot of extra guns down there to restore order to the area after that devastation. And so what happened was Eric Prince had a falling out with CIA here because they'd done a lot of black ops with them using the front of Blackwater. And Jeremy Scahill, he's an author. He wrote a wonderful book about Blackwater. You can get that on Amazon. But anyway, so Eric Prince picked up after he had problems here, and he started a new company in Dubai, which was, I think, Z Services. But when he left here, the Blackwater contracting company he started, Monsanto bought it. And so what Monsanto did, this is an example of a corporation that needed black ops, because Monsanto does a whole lot of dirty stuff under the table, which they do not want the civilian populations in whatever country they're operating in to know about. And this is the muscle behind their corporate stuff. So there's an example of a lower-level black op where there's a corporation that hires personnel like that. And so whatever there is, there's all the stuff in Afghanistan with the heroin and the opium crops, and we can talk about that later, those black ops there. But generally, how you get into it is you have to start, you have to have the training, you have to have some kind of military training, martial arts training. You have to be intelligent. You have to be adaptable, maybe to learn different languages in different countries. And you have to be, above all, absolutely honest and trustworthy. Because if things sour up and domestic law enforcement get involved, oftentimes people are killed.
But isn't this a bit of a bizarre, the whole scenario? Because you're talking about very illegal, very immoral stuff, but yet with a high code of honor almost and trust involved.
Yes, it is contradictory, but a black op by its nature is an operation that is to remain completely unknown. Now, that's the goal, but it doesn't always work that way. And so there's what they call blowback, and that is when a black op is set up and it's in the process of implementing it. Things happen, witnesses show up, things leak out from a variety of things, and then the black op's not black anymore. It's known a little bit. So then there's the next part of the black op thing where they have to cover it up. And we call that sanitizing the operation. So operations can be sanitized a lot of ways. One of the main things is make sure that it never gets into the press and it never gets into any civilian you know, radio or TV or anything like that. And so that's where they go in and take care of the witnesses, or they threaten them so that they'll never talk, and they might break into houses, and if there's someone took pictures, they make sure the film's gone. If there's any electronic recordings, they make sure all those disappear. And then that way, the blowback control ensures that the op stays as black as it possibly can. Because the idea is not to let anything out to anybody except for the principals and the people who set the op up, whether it's corporate, intelligence op, assassination op, bombing, whatever it is.
So the sanitation is part of it. It's part of the planning as well, that you have it with you in the background all the time.
Yes. And it's like on the Oklahoma City bombing as an example. They knew that was a black op, and they knew that it would be very public, and there'd be a lot of press attention, a lot of people, a lot of witnesses. So on an op like that, you know that there's no way, no matter what you do, you can keep it black. But what you can do is provide a cover story or a patsy. So on major black operations, I believe personally President Kennedy in Dallas was assassinated there. I have stood at the Texas Book Depository where Oswald stood and looked through there on that sixth floor. And that Texas live oak tree that blocks the view, there's no way. I'm a professional expert sniper, and I've shot guns for over 50 years, and we had the biggest gun shop here in Colorado and stuff, so I've shot a lot of military weapons and done a lot of stuff, and there is absolutely no way that Oswald was the only one there. So that was in my opinion, a black op, and it was a very high-level op. There's no way they can keep it black. There's just no way you can do it. Kennedy was too high profile, so you have to have a cover for the op. And you have to have a patsy. Sometimes in ops, they'll have two or three covers. So that the idea is you can't keep the op black, but you can obfuscate it, and you can make it so messy and so convoluted by all your cover ops that even though people know it was a black op, they can't figure out what really happened.
Do you know that I've spent some 30 years on Kennedy and other major assassinations as well. And one of the things that I keep bumping into is like this multi-layered, like where several operations is going on at the same time, but with different, their aim for the different operations are different, and they don't even know about each other. So it's pointing in all different directions at the same time. That is exactly what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yes, and the name we use for that, it's called an umbrella op. Okay, in other words, if you think about an umbrella, and let's look at the Kennedy thing just for an example. You have some shooters that's going to kill the president, and that's their op. And we call these parallel ops. There's one that's running. There's another one beside it. There's another one beside it, and they're all three going in the same direction. They're called parallel ops. They're all underneath the umbrella of the black op. And only the people at the very top, they know what each of the individual parallel operations underneath the umbrella. They're the only ones that know how they all tie together. The individual operatives that are running each parallel op underneath the umbrella op, they don't know each other's existence. You know, another example is say Saddam Hussein had the Republican Guard. I mean, they had a bunch of guys over there that were bodyguarding. What CIA may do is they have an operative planted close to Saddam Hussein, but they want to move him closer. So what they do is they go to a second guy and they say, look, we want you to assassinate Saddam Hussein. And so he'll set up an assassination op. Then the CIA will go behind their back and tell their guy that's already in his organization, hey, we're going to stage an assassination op at this time, and we want you to warn Saddam so that it will appear that you're loyal to him, and thus you will move closer into his inner circle. So they will sacrifice the first assassin because he doesn't know about all the rest of it. And they'll sacrifice him, and then the guy that rats him out and tells Saddam about it, Saddam will say, oh, thank you, you saved my life, and then move him closer to the inner circle. And that's how they move an agent closer to someone. It's not necessarily that they wanted to kill Saddam, but they wanted to get an asset, an intelligence asset, closer to him so that they could get intelligence on him. The idea was not assassination. The idea was gaining more intelligence. And so that's an example of a two-staged umbrella op. The umbrella was to gain intelligence. And then you have the guy running underneath, parallel, who is doing the assassination, and then the guy running parallel who is trying to move closer to the target for intelligence. And so you're right. And I think they did that in Dallas, too, and they did it in Oklahoma City. And the more convoluted and the more parallel ops you have in, underneath the big umbrella of the main black op, there's more moving parts, and it's more complicated. But any form of blowback is usually in the form of confusion and chaos. And no matter what investigators try to do, no matter how many pieces of data they tie together 20 years later, they will never, ever be able to figure out what exactly happened. Because even the operatives in the op didn't know what was happening.
No, exactly. I mean, I don't think that – I think maybe sometimes the shooters are only informed about the look of the target. They don't even know the individual, the identity, but just that blue shirt, the white hat, whatever – coming closer at this with a spotter and a breakdown guy. But can I ask you, because I've seen this several times where, for instance, an organization is being infiltrated, at least in my interpretation, where there's two individuals that come in more or less at the same time. Then one of them exposes the other one as a fraud or spy or whatever, and he goes down. But the one that had exposed him is then being treated like a hero and then goes up in the ranks within that organization without people from the outside understanding that they were actually in on it both. Would that be a correct way of understanding such
an operation?
Absolutely.
That's just the same thing with the example I was using about Saddam Hussein. That's exactly right. Oftentimes they'll do it with two or three people, and they'll do a succession of them. You know, one guy will expose one, and then they'll wait a while, and then they'll send another one, and then he'll expose him. And the guys that are coming in to infiltrate the organization don't know. They're not aware that the same people sending them are actually hiring and working with the guy that's already in there. And if they knew it, they wouldn't do it. So this is you're exactly right about that, and that's how they do it. And The layers of this, the deception is what, it gets so deep that there was a guy named James Angleton in the CIA here. He was the counterintelligence officer for a while, and the main one in charge. And he called it the wilderness of mirrors, because during the Cold War with the Russians and here in America, and the nuclear stuff and the Sputnik, you know, and the space race, all that, there was a large number of double agents, triple agents, agents that were defecting. And a lot of them were bringing guys across in West Germany there at the wall. They were sending defectors posing as agents. They were sending agents posing as defectors. They were sending double agents posing as agents. I mean, it was all just so convoluted that he called it the wilderness of mirrors. And it's like standing in a big hall of mirrors in a maze. And you walk around the corner and you look at something, and it may be your reflection, but it may be a reflection of a reflection, or it may be a reflection of a reflection of a reflection, and you don't know what it is. You don't know if it's real or just a reflection. And so that's what he termed, because these ops can get so convoluted sometimes that even the people running them can't figure out what's going on. And then they lose control. And when control is lost, all kinds of bad things happen, and a lot of people die. There's mass cleanouts where they can't figure out who's the doubles, who's the triples. They can't figure out who the defectors are and if they're real. And so they just kill them all and start over again.
My God. There's one case in Sweden where a very young journalist, his name was Jan Guillou, and he did, and another guy called Peter Bratt, they went into an organization and they exposed what they claimed to be that the government was sort of doing targeting people for their political views in a country like Sweden. It was a big scandal, and it ended up with one of them pointing out the other one, then being treated like a hero, and then he was put in jail in Sweden for that he had exposed different things. But this Jan Guillou today is like an icon in Sweden. He was the head of the Journalist Association. He's been selling books in the millions. He's like, whenever there's a case, he's the one on TV. But what he's actually doing is he's like a doorman for the powers behind these structures. You know, anyone that gets close, they're up against him. But when these things happen, because when he was put in jail, my interpretation is that he was just put in jail and being educated. You know, that he was not at all in a cell. He was being educated in these different types of operations. And this is also what a lot of his books are about. He has high knowledge of very, very sophisticated intelligence works. And how would he know about these things just as an ordinary journalist? This thing with the jail thing, is that something you know about, that the jails or jail time is being used like that to prepare an individual?
Yeah, absolutely. When you're dealing with intelligence agencies around the world, you know, the Russians, they could capture, you know, some dissidents, and they can throw them in jail for speaking out against the Russian government. And then when they're sitting in jail, you know, they can do a little press release through the TASS news agency or whatever it was, and say, oh yeah, this dissident, he's suffering, and you know, he's paying for speaking out, and he's being punished. And then they let that ride for a while, and then when the guy gets out, he's a hero to the folk people and the lower people. And he did his prison time, and he's even more anti-Soviet than when he gets out, okay? And so the people really trust him, and they really admire him, because he did his prison time against the state. And the whole time, he could have been turned while he was in the jail and told that we want you to get out of jail now, and you're going to work for us, and you're going to feed us intelligence about the dissidence groups. We want you to go out there and build dissidence groups, and we want you to collect information on all the members while you're posing as this big anti-Soviet guy who just got out of prison and was punished. And so these type of things do occur. It's very difficult when you're dealing with intelligence agencies, as James Angleton and the CIA refer to. You can scratch your head. You can try to figure this stuff out. And then while you're trying to figure out what really happened, they can flip again and change again and be flipped another way because their son got shot or their friend got put in jail. So it is very difficult to understand these things.
Do you know, when I've spoken a lot with Chip Tatum, the CIA whistleblower as well, and And he was talking a lot about how the Bourne Identity movies are quite accurate when it comes to intelligence work on some levels, not so much the Hollywood type of fighting, but the way with hidden assets or sleeping assets or wannabes or used to bes, I don't know, everything. And he said that sometimes there are even assets that once they're activated by a phone call or so, nobody knows who they are and you can't pull it back. You can't say, no, sorry, we made a mistake. Once it's out there, they don't even know themselves who they are. Is that your experience as well?
Yes, absolutely. I myself have been involved in those mind control ops. They were terminal Black Op assassination programs at the highest level. That's what actually killed me when I died in the hospital from September 18th through September 22nd, 1991. We haven't really talked about this. Chapter 10 of this book, Choosing the Light, Dark Secrets of the Oklahoma City Bombing, we wrote, deals with CIA mind control, and it deals with the MK Ultra and MK Delta and Project Slammer and various other programs. I was directly involved in those, and I have quite a bit of information. It's going to take several things, and we will go through it all, but it's extremely high level, and it's not for the faint-hearted. But some of the people that were with me on some of the operations, they saw those Jason Bourne movies, and they said, Cody, that's just like you. Those movies are just like you. It's the same kind of life you lived. And so I was very high level operative, but I was not, you know, I did not work for the CIA directly, which is why they offered me very sensitive jobs like blowing up the Murrah building. They offered me some real, real sensitive jobs, and in my opinion, they're a lot worse than the Murrah building. But I am not prepared at this stage to talk about them right now. Some of the people are still alive, and it's extremely sensitive stuff. So, yes, they do. Well, if you go back in time a little bit, during the Cold War, in 1947, the head of the OSS was Alan Dulles, and then they changed over and morphed over to the Central Intelligence Agency. And what had happened, I'm sure you know a lot about this, and Jim probably did, but the guy we talked to yesterday, just to give a brief summary of this, the Nazi SS, they were losing the war, and there was a group of them that did not want to be captured by the Russians, so they traded intelligence. And they had some mind control programs, genetic experiments at Auschwitz with Dr. Mengele and so forth. And so they microfilmed a lot of their records and covert stuff and approached the OSS, and they said, you know, Operation Paperclip, we will trade you this intel if you'll take us to the States. And they gave them fake IDs and stuff. And so that was the predecessor to our mind control programs and the MK Ultra program and so forth. And so then the CIA began experimenting with things. And what had happened during the Cold War buildup with the space race with Sputnik and all of the buildup of the nuclear weapons, Ethel and Julian Rosenberg had been tried here in the States for passing secrets to the Soviets about the nuclear stuff, and they were hung. And there was a big race. And one of the things in the race was how to build assassins. And chemical interrogation, the CIU, that's Chemical Interrogation Unit, there's black ops units that use drugs to get people to talk. If you catch an agent or a defector and they won't tell you what you need to know, there's all these forms of torture devised, and one of them was chemical. And as you fast forward past World War II, all these new chemicals started coming out, sodium pentothal and various things, and then they morphed into opiate-based psychedelics, and they were used in conjunction with various forms of torture, electric shocks, beatings, various kinds of torture, and then they mixed them with the mind control drugs to try to get people to talk. And so in response to that, as a counterintelligence thing to that, if you were going to take an assassin, say an American CIA assassin was going to go kill a Russian general or something, what you would do, you'd have that assassin go over there, but they were splitting their minds with the Manchurian candidate stuff. So if they were caught over there in Russia and tortured with all these new drugs and all these new interrogation techniques, that they would not know who they were. And what they created was an alter personality. So the alter would be the assassin, and then the regular personality would be the person. And the person might be a plumber or a carpenter, and he wouldn't know himself that he was an assassin. But once the handler that had the keys and the codes to flip his personality over to the altar, then he would know who he was and complete his mission. And that's what the kind of stuff that those Bourne movies were based on. However, after the Senator Frank Church hearings in 75 here in the U.S. where they exposed some of these CIA programs, you know, CIA in classic fashion told them, well, we'll stop and we'll quit this. It's real dirty, nasty stuff. So, and then they just morphed and went underground deeper. And that morphed into other programs like the Stargate program, you know, David Morehouse, Joseph McMoneagle. They were doing remote viewing things. And then it just kept going. And they got better and better at splitting personalities using ritual-based sexual trauma and so forth to create alter personalities. They got better at controlling them. One of the problems they had with the breakdown of these assassins was that their techniques, if they were sent overseas and they couldn't get access to their handlers to have reinforcement for the programming, then they began breaking down. And that's what the Jason Bourne movies were, where he would be having flashbacks and memories, and he couldn't remember all of it, but he knew something happened, and he was trying to piece it together. And so when the breakdown of these things occurred, they could usually try to fix it, and if they couldn't, they just terminated him and get a new one and start over. So it morphed over a period of time, from late post-World War II. You know, they dropped the nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and August 6th of 45 and 9th of 45. And after that, this whole thing broke off. It was nuclear arms races, you know, space races, mind control. They were opening the Pandora box of all this new technology. And then as this moved through the decades, it was also accentuated by the advent of microprocessing technology and computers and cell phones and supercomputers. There were more and more satellites being launched. All the technology was getting better and better. And so these programs morphed from chemical interrogations to electronic interrogations and off into the whole Pandora's box of mind control stuff. And then they, in Project Slammer, that's the one I was in, I can talk. It's going to take an hour or two just to get into that program. I have declassified documents from Director Central Intelligence and a whole bunch of research. It's real scientific. There's electronics involved, microwaves, there's chemicals. So we'll do that maybe one time, but I know a whole lot of stuff because I died from it. I was targeted and I killed in it. So, but that's a real big subject. But anyway, the Jason Bourne movies, that's very accurate, and Chip is absolutely right about that. This thing morphed through time, and the stuff they have now is extremely advanced, and they've gotten a lot better once they split someone's personality to make an assassin. They've got a lot better in controlling the breakdown. Because, see, the spirit in the human being, if they do that stuff to you like they did Kathy O'Brien in MKUltra back in the 60s, if they do that kind of thing and then don't reinforce it, the earlier programming methods begin to decay and degenerate, and then people begin to remember, and they don't like that. Generally, they terminate them so that they won't expose the program itself. But the stuff they have now has been morphed and tweaked, and they have a lot of field data and lots and lots of subjects, and they have manicured these programs so that breakdown doesn't occur so much. And then when the assassin completes his mission, he just kills himself. And that way they don't have to deal with later on that they break down mentally and begin to have trouble and then spill their beans to some civilian psychologist. A lot of people don't know, but Dr. Jolene West was in the CIA mind control programs, and then he was one of the ones sent to assess the damage at the Alfred P. Murrah building after it was bombed. He was a team sent there. He's one of the CIA's main mind control guys, and he was sent down there on this little team to supposedly assess the mental and emotional impact on the civilian population of such a domestic bombing. And what he was really doing was checking on all the mind-controlled assassins and people the CIA had already tweaked in their heads in the area. I mean, this is a massive thing. They've got plants and agents all around the world, and so does the Russians. And the Mossad has their groups, and MI6. Each of these countries have opened the Pandora's box. And I'd like sometime, if you can, it's probably going to take at least an hour, maybe more. We will go through just Project Slammer itself. I have a lot of data here. There was an above board part of it, which was vanilla, and then there was an underneath part, which was the black ops. And so that's the stuff nobody knows about. And a lot of that stuff is still highly classified because it's the core and the root of many of the current programs that are going on today.
Cody, can I ask you? I had a threat once that was indirect, but Chip said it was a death threat when I asked him. Could I ask you if I quote more or less? I got it by email from somebody I thought was a friend, and it turned out later that he was very deeply involved in these things. And he was talking about killer teams that worked in the light and in the dark. He said they were above the Delta teams, but that they work in the light and in the dark. What would your interpretation be of those words, in the dark and in the light, when it comes to
these
teams?
Yeah, that's really plain. In the light, the killer teams are, okay, let's say you have a metaphysical community. There's people who are doing spiritual work, meditation, church people, people who are generally of the love and light polarity and generally involved in spiritual things, healing, temples, helping children, missionary work. Okay, so in those fields, there are legitimate people who are Christ-like and who do work with love and light. And the assassins will infiltrate those groups and then use that as their cover. They will appear to be good meditators and they'll do charity work and they'll help sick children and take shoes to the barefoot children in the camps the refugee camps in Syria or Lebanon or whatever, and they'll be really good people. Okay? And they've infiltrated the light and use it as a cover so that when they're called on a particular mission, then they can assassinate who they need to. Because people that are in spiritual things, look at Martin Luther King. He was a spiritual leader here in America, a Christian-based black preacher, and there was a lot of light around him and a lot of church groups and a lot of love and people. That would be a perfect example of it, of you would infiltrate that group and work for years appearing to be a light, and then when you got the order, you'd kill Martin Luther King. Okay, so then the dark, those are the guys that infiltrate, and they're satanic. Aleister Crowley, they're the SS occult divisions in Nazi Germany. They had SS occult divisions. There were groups inside the SS, and they were satanic. They did the pentagram worship and all kinds of summoning demons, probably child sacrifices, that kind of thing. And they appear, they go in that group, and they're of the dark, and they're satanic, and they witchcraft, and then they do their assassinations from there. So that's what I think they're referring to, the light and the dark. The light ones are the hard ones, because some of the people that I've seen, Jim Jones, the Guyana massacre, you're probably familiar with that one.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And so they appear to be of the light, and they go off and build a compound, and they have these people following. That whole thing smacks to me like it was a CIA mind control program, and it was a field test of operational integrity, operational security, and operational methods. And then they killed all of them at the end, you know, after they got done with whatever they were doing. I don't have any knowledge. I was not involved in that particular thing. But when I saw it all in the paper, that's what it looked like to me. It's like it's camouflaged up as some guy of the light with all these light guys, and they're religious, and they're going to help the people and all the crap. And then the whole thing's an op underneath. And most of the people there didn't know what was going on, and then they just killed them anyway after they used them. So that thing to you, the light and the dark, that he just trying to threaten you and scare you and create fear in your mind so that it will cripple your mind and you will not be able to do the work you're doing. See, the underneath all this stuff, all the MK Ultra, all the stuff the Russians were doing with implantable electrodes and the chemicals and all the things going on, all this, if you don't have fear in your mind, that's the one thing that begins to defeat these programs. Truth and a balanced mind without fear and spiritual connectiveness defeats these things eventually. They don't, you know, people don't always win, and the dark side wins, but they're just trying to make you afraid. But the assassins are, see, if like you're a yoga teacher or whatever and you do spiritual work, that threat was, okay, we can send someone in your group, someone who you believe is a yoga instructor and someone you believe is a good meditator and someone you believe is of the light. And from that platform, someone you trust, that's how we're going to get to you. And I think that's what he meant.
I tell you, he didn't scare me, but I was taken out for weeks because I felt so betrayed, I must say, because I thought we were friends, and it came as an absolute shock for me. So I wasn't prepared at all. And so it was like being stabbed from behind.
Well, Ole, I just want to say this is real, and this is a great point you're making here, because this anybody that's hearing this, no matter what your position in a particular society is, you thought he was your friend. See, if you're dealing with a true mind-controlled assassin, okay, whether it's CIA or KGB, FSB, whatever country, that's not the point. If they've been professionally mind-controlled by an intelligence agency, all right, what you're dealing with is their normal personality. It's who they really are. And you will never see or have access to the alter personality that was created by the intelligence agency. Only the handlers in the agency that have the codes that can trigger and flip that person from his normal personality to the alter personality. Only those people get to see both personalities because they're the ones that created them. But you've got a guy, and in his own mind, he is your friend. He doesn't know that he's an assassin sent there to kill you until they flip him and use the code, and then he switches to the altar. We dealt with some people here. One of them's name was Annie Cunningham. Her father worked at Area 51 here in the Nevada desert, high-level, top-secret clearance. And I can talk about Annie because she's gone now. And we did some healing work here on her at the healing center we have. But Annie had been professionally mind-controlled from the age of 5. They had Catholic priests at a school. They were really CIA personnel. It was one of their front ops in MKUltra. And they put her on tables, and they gang-raped her, and they did everything. But whenever they gave her an opiate-based psychedelic drug to begin these rape sessions, they were using sexually-based trauma, to split her personality. They put the bright lights on her face, and they'd put a picture of two dolphins swimming in opposite directions, or a pair of squiggly lines, or they have various symbols. That was the handler's signal. And so every time she was hurt and abused sexually, then she would have to look at these pictures. And over a while, when your mind goes into the cognitive dissonance threshold, that's the CDT, that's the point at which your conscious mind is overloaded with so much pain, so much fear, so much terror, that the self-protection mechanism built into your brain cuts in, and then it shuts off your mind, and it blanks out, and the people don't remember, but it's down there somewhere in the subconscious mind. And so that trigger is set up at that point, at the cognitive dissonance threshold, okay? And so when the subject is awake later on, the mind's been blanked out. They don't have any memory they were gang raped and all this stuff happened. But if they put that trigger, the handler puts the trigger and shows it to them, then that flips the mind to the altar. And that was a very primitive forms of stuff they were testing. That's Illuminati-based sexual ritual abuse. It's been going on a long time. It ties into some of the satanic witch stuff over there in Europe. You probably know a lot more about that than me. But the intelligence agencies picked up this stuff up from the Nazis, and they got it from the Illuminati. It's been passed down a long time. Then they perfected it with new drugs, new computers, new forms of ELF, extremely low-frequency sound waves, various forms of modulated microwaves and so forth, and then that morphed into Project Slammer. So your friend Ole, that you thought was your friend, he was. But if he was a professionally mind-controlled assassin, neither you nor him knew about that alter personality that was just sitting there, hidden inside his mind.
Somehow that makes me happy, because I really felt that we were friends, so...
Well, you were. He was.
Yeah.
And he can't help it. Some of these people, if they take them like Annie Cunningham, this was a classic case. We worked on her a long time. She wrote. We had her write out journals. We tried to find out every... She was an active member in an MK Ultra program, just like Kathy O'Brien was. And she had turned out to be a prostitute in Las Vegas and stuff, and she was shooting drugs, with needles and stuff, and she was an alcoholic, and she knew there was something years later deep in her psyche that knew something was wrong and something had been done to her that had turned her life into this hellstorm, and she came for healing, and we made a lot of progress with her, but we worked on several MK Ultra people. Some of them's minds were completely blank. They have whole, like, year, 6 months, 8 months times, they have absolutely no memory at all of where they were, what they were doing, or anything. And so these type of things are very high level. And when you're trying to deprogram a individual that has been professionally mind control programmed by some intelligence agency, it's an extremely tricky thing. Oftentimes, they were programmed to commit suicide if they ever discovered their alter personality. So this guy was your friend. He was your real friend in his real mind. But his alter, he could just pick up a knife and coldly look you in the eyes and cut your throat without any problem. And if the mind controls were done right, then they could flip him back over to his personal regular personality. And he wouldn't even remember what the hell he'd just done. And he'd go, oh, my God, who killed my friend Ole? What happened? And that's what Sirhan, with the Robert Kennedy assassination, we have extensive files. I wrote a little bit about this book, but as you well know with the Kennedy thing, this kind of stuff takes books and books and books and books. But I have a whole lot of information about Sirhan and how he was mind controlled and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it's a big, big project. You talk about Black Ops, this stuff is the heart of Black Ops. You can take a guy like Timothy McVeigh and tell him, we want you to drive a Ryder truck in front of that Murrah building and detonate at 9 o'clock. Now, okay. And they do it. They don't even know they're part of a bigger op. They don't know the building was wired already. They don't know those bombs have been sitting in there 2 weeks. They don't know about Gulf War Syndrome cover-up. They don't know about any of it. They just go do what they're told, and if they've been professionally mind-controlled, they flip them back after they complete their mission, and they don't remember driving the Ryder truck. They don't remember flipping the detonator switch. And so that's why they were doing this. This was the heart of double agents, triple agents, all this stuff in the deep, deep black. Some of the ops that we that I was on, we were black on black. Okay? They would have a black op going on somewhere in some country, Panama or something, and the normal CI guys that were working it, or whoever they were, there might have been Delta Force or whatever was going on, they had a black op. And then that black op went sideways for some reason. And then I would get a call, and they'd say, we want you to go do something here. And it was black on black. Okay? And they had to do that once in a while. Sometimes they'd order people to kill their own team members in extreme circumstances because the blowback had to be minimized. And the problem with planning field ops like the Murrah bombing or any of this other stuff, assassinations, any of this, is that you can make all the plans you want in a desk, you know, in a nice air-conditioned office. And then when you get out in the field, all these unknowns come in. You know, a bug might crawl up in a radio set and short-circuit something, and you're out in the middle of nowhere and your radio doesn't work anymore. You know, any number of weird, strange things can happen. And then the op goes sideways. And then you can't be extracted. Your pickups aren't going to work. You can't have comms to them to get picked up and leave the country. So there's all these things that happen. And sometimes the black op goes sideways, and they figure the best way to control the blowback is just terminate the whole op. You terminate the compromise and kill all your own team members and leave. That way, no one ever knows the black op was even there in the first place or that it went sideways to begin with. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and then the person who killed all the rest will be killed by someone else who doesn't know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, he comes back home and he slips on a banana peel, or he's in the Walmart parking lot and a car just comes in and creams him, you know, and these kind of things happen. And so it becomes very, very tricky. And that's why they started going to psychics and using very high-level psychics like Ingo Swan from Israel. He'd been in the Israeli army, and in 1972, the Stanford Research Institute out in California was a front for CIA mind control stuff. And they're experimenting with the psychics and how to, you know, because psychics can pick up on things that nobody knows. You know, you can try all kinds of ways to hide a black op or cover a black op, but a psychic can see right through it. And so they started experimenting with using psychics and using all these new drugs and using all this electronics and modulated microwaves. And so pretty soon this gets into a can of worms. It's multidisciplinary science, biology, biophysics, biochemistry, electronics, electrical engineering, applied physics, organic chemistry, physical chemistry. I mean, it's the heart of how our mind works itself.
Mm.
So,
Cody,
yeah.
Can I ask, you know, because since I've been experiencing different things during these years, because I've been approached by different individuals that, you know, like in my position, I have no idea who it is who approaches me. Just like when you approached me, I had no idea who you were and so on. And there was this individual who contacted me. He had a Facebook account that was very anonymous. And he said, I want to talk to you. And he said, can we meet? And I said, tell me what you want. Anyway, in the end, he flew down from a Scandinavian country. To this very day, I don't know his real identity. And we met in a bar down here on the coast of Spain. And my sweetheart was with me in the background because she was very nervous for me to go and see him because, well, you know, with these situations, you don't know am I going to get out there alive, or is he there to sponsor me, or is he just, does he want to have a coffee? I mean, who knows? Anyway, so he was very secretive, and we had to put our cell phone in one of these bags that with no reception. I don't know, all of this crap. And he said he wanted to check me for wires, and I could do the same with him. I said, I don't care at all. What I say stands wherever. And anyway, the thing was that when I talked to him, and my sweetheart noticed that as well, he was very military in his way of his body language and so on when he was talking about different things. And then he said that he never told me what he was into, but I believe it was some kind of military surveillance thing. And then he said that he left, and he sort of really done a lot of sort of personal spiritual development and type of things. And when he started talking about these things, his body just changed. His body language, he was almost a bit gayish in his way of moving, and with the other thing, very militant. And after a while, he started talking to me in a way that was really bizarre. When he was he started saying, yeah, but do you really think that one day when you die, do you think that the little Ole, the boy, will you have betrayed him by focusing so much on these serious things and forgot about that? And it was like I felt like he was in my mind trying to mess around with stuff. You know, I got teary eyed. I felt like, I just felt like crying. And at the same time, I just felt like giving him the middle finger, just like, fuck off. What are you doing? Back off. You know, you're getting in. I felt that he was trying to get inside my head.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I tell you what, Ollie, if you give we'll do 2 hours if you got time one time, and we'll do nothing but about Project Slammer, and we'll get into all this stuff, because what you could have been, that could have been a two-man tail thing. He could have been there to get you at a time and place. They could have been sitting across the street using a modulated microwave device or something. I'll say this as a teaser to this Project Clamor stuff, because it is extremely advanced. I know a whole lot of stuff about it, and I have degrees in mathematics and physics and stuff, and flew the space shuttle simulator at NASA and all that. I know stuff that is amazing. I'm not going to talk about classified things. I've seen some files which I will not talk about, but I can really open the can of worms up for people. But a lot of times they'll have a guy like that get you at a time and place. Then they'll have another person over there, and they will be doing something to you. And then we'll just tease it with this thing. This was a CIA operation called Holy See, and it was in the Vatican in Rome, okay, for a front. Now, here's what had happened. During these programs that had morphed, you know, through the MK Ultra and MK Delta programs, and they were getting more and more sophisticated with all the electronics and the drugs and the mind control techniques, they had opened up Pandora's box, you know, of controlling the mind. And so it got to the point in the 80s, the Soviets, we were building a new embassy in Moscow, and so the Soviets were covertly bombing it with microwaves. And they were testing modulated microwaves. And a lot of our personnel got leukemia, sickness and everything. Well, the CIA had some double agents from the KGB, and they knew that they were running these mind control ops with microwaves on our embassy. So the CIA sat back in classic fashion, and they were just going to piggyback and glean the info from the KGB on how it was affecting our personnel. So they didn't say anything to our guys. And our embassy guys all got sick, and the CIA remained quiet. Then they used their double agents to transfer all the operational knowledge gleaned from this microwave mind control program. And so they morphed that into what they call a synthetic telepathy device. This thing was produced by Covert Contract and E-Systems down in El Paso, Texas. And basically, to make a long story short, it was like a suitcase-sized thing. It was a digital microprocessor, and it had a microwave transmitting dish that you could point at a target, and you could speak into the device. It would electronically transfer those words and send it through microwaves, and then the people could hear it in their heads. And it's hence synthetic telepathy, a way to send thoughts into other people's heads. And the way they did that was that the natural resonance frequency of the human cranium is approximately 840 megahertz in the microwave range. So this device modulated the microwaves and resonated them inside the cranium. And through a complex system of biochemical and biological reactions that deal with the endocrine system, these thoughts were heard in people's heads. So to field test this, all right, they were field testing a brand new microwave device called a synthetic telepathy device that would send thoughts to someone's head. All right. So they had priests, these were CIA personnel, that had infiltrated the Vatican. And they were posing as priests. So the other guys on the op would wait till the priest went to sleep. They'd target them with a microwave dish, and they'd send certain thoughts to them. Well, they'd get up in the morning, and they'd have a dream or vision or whatever. And then the other priests that were CIA agents, they'd start talking to them, and the guy said, yeah, I had a weird dream. And he'd go, what was it? So the guy would tell him what was in his head. Then the field agents that were collecting that data would later go back to the guys who were sending the data, and they'd compare the effectiveness of the transmission. Then they would later tweak the electronics and the microwaves to increase the efficiency of this device. Now, one of my principals in a different country asked me one time, he said, Cody, can you get me a synthetic telepathy device from the CIA? And I said, well, that stuff's all highly classified, and it's going to get you buku money. And even though with the money, they still might not be able to do it. This is, you don't understand what you're dealing with here. We never did anything like that. It's just too much. But the devices do exist. I've seen one myself. I didn't use it. But one of the guys we worked with had one, and they are real. And the other thing they did was find out the auditory nerve in your ear that goes from your eardrum into your brain and transmits sound signals from your ears. They learned how to use frequencies, electromagnetic frequencies, to kind of tap into that nerve and induce electrical currents in it, which you would interpret as sound. And they were experimenting with sending thoughts that way too, through the auditory nerve with electromagnetics rather than the synthetic telepathy device from E-Systems that was using microwaves inside the human cranium. See, there's two different ways to get to the brain that way, one through the ear and one through the brain itself. And they've experimented with a lot of different things like that. But you could have been sitting there at that cafe with this person, and that person was sitting there talking to you, and they could have been hitting you with some of these devices. I have fillings in my teeth. They're the old fillings, mercury fillings from old time when I was young. And I've been hit 3 or 4 different times with microwave devices, and my teeth always start hurting. Because what happens when you're hit with a microwave device like that, you may not feel it. It's kind of like an x-ray at the dentist's office. The x-rays go through you and you don't even feel them. But with microwaves, the fillings in your teeth are heavier metals, and they absorb microwaves at a different rate than your softer connective tissues. And so they absorb it more and they heat up more. And that puts pressure on the nerves that are quite sensitive in your teeth. And so I always know when I'm being hit with a microwave device because my teeth will start hurting. And some people that don't have the fillings or don't know about this knowledge, they can be sitting there and they can be hit with these microwave devices, and it's just like putting a hot dog in the microwave. You watch a hot dog and cook it, it'll start blowing up and all, and then your capillaries and your heart and your brain can be affected, and death or stroke or heart attack can occur, and that's why they were experimenting with these things. They were not only experimenting with them to control the minds of people, but also to kill them if they needed, and not have to send a physical assassin in. They could kill them electromagnetically with a directed energy weapon at a distance. and leave no telltale traces. There would be no poisons or no bullet holes, nothing that a standard forensic autopsy could even find. And so when we get into the Project Slammer thing, I can go way, way into more detail about all this stuff. Probably tell you some stuff you and your audience have never even heard, but I live this stuff because I have a very high intelligence and scored in the top 1% in the United States on the SAT test in physics, and that's why CI came to recruit me in the first place. But I know a whole lot of stuff about it. I've done a lot of covert research, and I had a lot of stuff we saw at Los Alamos down there in the labs in New Mexico, top secret stuff. I didn't get copies of it. That's a felony, but I saw it with my eyes, and I remember a lot of it. And the research they were doing is absolutely extraordinary.
Do you know, when I met this guy, one of the things that he kept saying, you know, that it was so secret, he didn't want anyone to know he was there, and he said, I'm taking a great risk. And I said, who are you talking to when you talk about risk? I mean, I'm here meeting you. I live this risk all the time. And anyway, so what I noticed was that he had rented an Audi, you know, like a four-seater, but it was only him. And also he saved the receipt because from the coffee type of thing. I just felt, if you're here and you want to go secret and nobody should know, why are you saving the receipt, you know? And why did you rent such a big car? So I had this feeling that he was not alone. And he also wanted to meet the very next day, even though he didn't come up with anything. I was still confused what was the reason we met, but I feel what you're just telling me now is that his job was just to put me there in that location at that time.
Yeah, Ole, they could have had a three-man team. In other words, his job was to put you at that location and get you there, okay? Because they know you're a conspiracy researcher, and so you're naturally curious, and so you sit there at that thing. Then they got another guy doing some type of surveillance or microwaving or something. And then the third guy's at your house while you're there. And they clandestinely enter your house, and they could have bugged your house or bugged your computer. Or in a more sinister fashion, one of the ops I saw, they had this stuff. It's not on any of the PDRs, the physician's desk references. It's classified. Yeah. It's a chemical, you know, and it's clear, and you coat the inside of a drinking glass with it, and it dries clear to the touch. And it's perfectly tasteless and odorless, and then when you pour a drink, any kind of liquid, it activates the chemical. And then when you consume it, you know, death usually comes in about the first minute or so of supposedly natural causes, you know, stroke or heart attack. But as the forensic techniques on poisonings have generally increased with the overall level of technological development, these types of poisons can be found. An example is a GC mass spec. That's what they call it. It's a gas chromatography mass spectrometer. And they can, after your body's gone and dead, they can take tissue samples and they gasify them, and they put it in centrifuges and spin it out and then run it through a spectrographic analysis. And they can tell which molecules, molecular groups, what kind of poison was there, what the chemicals are. So then they started switching over to protein-synthesized poisons, which couldn't be picked up by a GC mass spec. So if you want to do a high-level hit and poison someone that way, then there's always going to be a forensic autopsy. And if the guy's like, you know, Queen Elizabeth or something, I mean, they're going to use every single technique they have to find out what happened. So if you use a protein-synthesized poison in their drink, then, you know, the natural metabolic process of the body synthesizes the poison out while it's killing you, so that as the poison's killing you, it's disappearing. Okay? Now, people may think this is all advanced. That's kids play. That's Stone Age stuff. What I'm talking about and what I'm going to talk about in the Project Slammer thing is much more advanced, but we have to go through some science. We have to go through a little chemistry, a little biochemistry, a little physics. It's a multidisciplinary approach. If you really want to understand the heart of black ops, we have to go through this, a little bit of science and all, so people know where they're at. These guys have been doing this, Ole, for since 1947, you know, after the war. They've been perfecting it. They've been tweaking it, not just here in America. I mean, this is highly classified research on how to control the human mind, how to create assassins with altered personalities, how to terminate targets at a distance with absolutely no trace and without having to send a physical assassination into some country, a physical assassin into some country and bother with all the, you know, the customs and the horse shit. It eliminates the blowback, basically. And so this is why they were doing it. It's the big stuff, and it's the real stuff. And they could have had a three-man team on you, you know, and one guy's getting you to the table, the other guy's doing his surveillance or doing the microwaves, and the third one's doing something at your house. When you get high enough level.
He actually wanted if he could come to my house the very next day, and I said absolutely not.
Yeah.
So, and I live out in the middle of nowhere, so I don't think they knew where I was. But can you give some kind of explanation to the shift in his body language from?
Yeah, he could have been being shift, slip into an altered personality. But you know, this is real tricky stuff, Ole, because when you can talk about intelligence agencies taking a normal person, like in the Jason Bourne thing, and creating alter personalities and building assassins. Okay, that's great. But what happens if you take a person who is not normal? What if you take a schizophrenic and then you try to do this to him? Okay, what if that man that met you had actually worked for all this high-level stuff that you said, and he had been exposed to so many microwaves and so many electric fields, and he had electromagnetic sensitivity syndrome, the ESS, or maybe he was on some kind of drugs, or maybe he was already mentally imbalanced, to bipolar or mood swings or whatever. See, we are also dealing with the psychology of the human itself. And so this thing gets incredibly complicated to try to figure out. And without having any of his psych profiles and psychological profiles, I can't answer that question. It's like saying, Cody, how long is a string? Until I have that string in my hand, I can't answer that question.
Well, it sure was an interesting meeting, I can tell you that. But can I ask you, before we end this, there was a documentary maker, his name was Alan Frankovich. He was the first one who did a documentary about the Gladio network, where an incredible researcher, and he was given some very, very sensitive information about the assassin who assassinated the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, and he was going to meet up with a person at the George Bush Airport, of all places, where he was going to get the payment for the documentary and some highly sensitive information. He passed through the passport control, and then he just fell over. I've spoken to people that have been close to him. He died there, and they said that his heart had it looked like his heart had sort of grown in size and exploded almost. What does that tell you? Is that something that resonates?
You know, that could have been a lot of things, but they do have poisons that are activated electromagnetically. In other words, those metal detectors and stuff at the airport, they operate at certain frequencies. The companies that build those, generally, one company can build a bunch of those, and they can be spread all around the world in various airports at Heathrow or Kennedy Airport here in the States, or that any of them, anywhere. So if he was given a poison that could be activated by that particular frequency, in other words, if intelligent agent knew he was fixing to take a flight, they could put some stuff in his coffee, you know, a few hours before going to the airport, and he'd be fine. But if he got to that particular frequency where that stuff was activated at, then he could die there. And that may be that. It may be something else. Without access to toxicological reports and forensic autopsies, all of this is just speculation. I mean, I'm a scientist. I try to work with empirical data. The problem with these black ops and all these high-level things are that that empirical data is not present. And then if it is, and they want to cover it up, minimize blowback, then the data's changed or the data's lost or some other thing happens. So when you're getting into this world, I mean, he could have had some congenital heart defect from his past or something, but it's hard to say. It's it could be and it couldn't be, and that's that world that James Angleton, CIA counterintelligence chief, he saw at the top. He was the leader. He saw the top. A lot of people in the CIA thought he was crazy and thought he was an asshole, and other people worshipped him. But he was real paranoid and real strange because he dealt in that world that we're talking about of things where it could be this way, it could be that way, maybe it's this way. And it's very difficult to know the – okay, you have to know what you know, but you have to leave open in your mind and leave a space for things that you don't know.
Yeah. Him being at that location, doing what he was, and then that happened at that exact spot, I mean, the chances of him dying naturally is not so big, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, especially when you're talking about he's moving sensitive documents and so forth. If someone's in a real high-level thing, the threat level or threat assessment of that would be high, and in those areas where that is high, then the chances of some type of exotic and strange poison or electromagnetic attack or something like that is much higher. I mean, if it was just some housewife that was going to buy some dish soap at the grocery store, they wouldn't waste their time on all this high-level stuff. But if he was involved in secretive and sensitive stuff and some other group certainly didn't want that information divulged, then the chances are some foul play was involved of some kind, but and that's why all these assassinations, different things. That's what they were leading to with all these programs, was to be able to maintain plausible deniability. That no matter if it was a janitor or a president, they could kill them, and no one would know what happened. No one would know that it was done by their unseen hand. And that's the bottom line, is to have the power to terminate, but not get caught, not and with minimal blowback.
Yeah.
That's a black op.
Listen, Cody, I really, really want to thank you for sharing this incredible information with us. And if you could please let our listeners know how to get in touch with you or how to get your book, or if there's any way we can support you, please let us know.
Yeah, what we do is, I'm sitting right here at my house. I'm not trying to hide anymore or anything. I'm just going to speak the truth, and the chips can fall where they may. However, one of the directors of CIA, I think it was William Colby, he said the same thing, you know, and he testified against Congress. And expose some of the CIA's family jewels, they call them, some of the secrets. And then he later retired, and he said the same thing, I'm not going to live in fear. And they eventually found his body washed up, said it was a canoeing accident, which I doubt. I think he was taken and tortured and then made it look like a drowning accident. But I'm basically the same way. I'm just going to tell the truth. And so my email here at home is, and you can get book copies through this right now, it's Cody, C-O-D-Y, Golden, G-O-L-D-E-N, E-L-K, @yahoo.com. That's my Indian name. I'm part Cherokee and part white. Cody Golden Elk. And by the way, I want to throw in, the CIA did genealogy studies, and they found that when of all the races, you know, white, black, Asian, Mexican, that the race of people that had the highest incident of natural psychism or natural psychic ability just happened to be the race that had Cherokee, Indian, and Caucasian mix. And that's what I am. So out of all that group, and when we get into the Project Clamor thing, I'm going to talk about psychics. I'm going to talk about the Stargate program. And I'm going to talk about the Philadelphia experiment and the stuff that went on, because I actually worked with some of the people who were involved in these high-level things. I was actually hired to bodyguard some of the scientists that their patents were so top secret that the NSA, when they filed them here in the United States, they classified them under national security. And so I can tell those stories too. So
it's going to be amazing, Cody. Once again, thank you ever so much from all of us to you for what you're doing.
Thank you so much for listening to Light on Conspiracies, the place where truth and love transcend the darkness. Take care and see you soon.
Coup d'etat in slow motion. Connecting the dots between the assassinations of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, JFK, Robert Kennedy, and John Lennon. Now available on Amazon and lightonconspiracies.com. Coup d'etat in slow motion.
May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who heard us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light.
Time.